Today on Against the Grain, the term socialism has, amazingly, gone from one consigned to Cold War obscurity to the self-description of several prominent U.S. politicians. But what does socialism mean, and how could we ever manage to get there? Jacobin magazine founder Bhaskar Sankara argues that socialism is in fact achievable and maps out a path to emancipation, first through social democratic reforms, but not stopping there. He also lays out the perils of partial reform of the capitalist system and the need to abolish it altogether. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. We have been told, ad nauseum in fact, that there is no alternative to the capitalist system and that any attempt to create something better will end badly. So it's remarkable that the word socialism has had a new lease on life. Bernie Sanders had something to do with it, of course, but equally, so has the publication Jacobin, which has been enormously influential on the rising number of especially young people who now identify as socialist or have flocked to the Democratic Socialists of America, a formerly tiny organization that now has 55,000 members. Bhaskar Sankara founded Jacobin 9 years ago. In his latest book, The Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Era of Extreme Inequality, published by Basic Books, he traces the history of socialism and considers what it might look like in the future. Bhaskar, the Cold War left one of its deepest marks on the U.S. left. In fact, it delegitimized it utterly. It's hard to find another country where the anti-communist backlash was so intense as here. So it seems especially remarkable that the term socialist has managed to lose its Cold War unspeakability. What do you attribute that to? It can't just be Bernie Sanders, who has been around forever after all.
Well, I think a large part of it is generational. I was born in 1989, which makes me, by the standards of DSA, now like an old hand. So most of these people, I think, that are getting attracted to the left are growing up in an era after the Cold War. A lot of these young people, I'm sure, on your show, I've heard it alone on your show a dozen or so times of people citing that Pew survey about more young people have favorable opinions in socialism than capitalism. So there has been this transformation of perceptions about what socialism means. I actually think a lot of the credit, in a sense, is owed to the right. The right has attacked every mild program of social reform as socialist. To the point that I think young people don't have a great sense of what socialism is, but at the very least are associating it with social programs as opposed to with breadlines and gulags and things like that.
Well, that amorphousness of what socialism actually means for people, I think we could discuss it for a while, but what does it mean to you? When you use the term socialism, what does that encompass? Would you put social democracy in that? Would you put Marxism or communism in that?
Well, to me, socialism is about taking democracy, saying it's a good thing, and trying to extend democracy as far as we can into social and economic spheres as well. So if democracy is a good thing when you're in the ballot box, like most Americans would think that's a good thing when we're voting, why don't we extend that logic to our workplaces as well? Why don't we at the very least guarantee a bedrock of health, of healthcare, of education, of childcare, of all these other social necessities that right now in the U.S., are largely dependent on your ability to pay or where you're born or whatever else, whereas in a just society, it would just be given to you by virtue of being a human being, allowing people to really reach their potential. Now, different parts of the socialist tradition have believed in this. My vision of socialism is a democratic, anti-authoritarian one, but I try to avoid the no true Scotsman thing of just saying, oh, that's bad, that's not real socialism. Real socialism is something good. And I think people can see through that. And it, often, like I occasionally get in conversations or debates with libertarians, and you could be talking to them about all these injustices, and they might even agree with you. And you think you're making progress, but then at the very end, they say, "Yeah, but that's not capitalism. That's crony capitalism." And I want to avoid doing that version for socialism. So I just have an ecumenical vision of like lots of things are socialism. Here's what I mean by it, and also, here's the broad animating principles of equality and democracy that should be behind every socialism that's worth its name.
But how would you distinguish, I guess, democratic socialism, which you're mm-hmm. advocating for, from social democracy, which I think is often what mm-hmm. people are thinking of when they use the term socialism today?
Yeah, I think that social democracy and other forms of socialism all had this common ancestor in these really big workers' parties of the late 19th century. But afterwards, at various points, because of lots of complicated history, they took diversion paths. And social democracy, I would say, aspires to deliver doses of socialism within capitalism. It gives people social rights and guarantees and things like that. But more fundamentally, it doesn't challenge the private ownership of production in the hands of people who own the firms that produce goods and services. Democratic socialism believes in all the same reforms as social democracy, but we go further and we say if we want to deepen these reforms, we want a truly just and egalitarian society, we need to question the fact that a small group of people control the things that we need to survive and control the places that we work at and have all this disproportionate sway in society. You can have a real democracy if the CEOs of places like Uber and Lyft like dictate the lives of millions of people. So I think we're the holdouts that are still questioning this fundamental nature of capital, the division between the people who own stuff and the people who don't own anything and have to just, you know, work for the people who own stuff.
The U.S. has a socialist history, and it's one that you trace in your book, The Socialist Manifesto. Tell us about that, which is something that seems, until recently, of a certainly different time, but totally different place.
Yeah, so 100 years ago, the Socialist Party wasn't quite a mass party in the United States, but it was pretty close to one. It had around 120,000 members. And the country at the time was only 120,000 people or so. So today, that'd be the equivalent of a party of, you know, over 300,000 people. They controlled the mayors of cities like Berkeley, Schenectady, Troy, New York, Milwaukee, a host of other cities. There was a few even elected representatives, a few congressional figures that were elected from the party. And in certain areas, like in the mostly Jewish enclaves of the Lower East Side, in some mining towns in the West, in even Oklahoma, the Socialist Party was a dominant, really mass party. So it seemed to be on its path to this relevancy. And the American tradition was a tradition of really violent labor unrest. So you got a bunch of really poor people and you gave them dynamite and you told them to clear out, you know, mine shafts and you paid them nothing and build railroads. And it's no surprise that sometimes we threw the dynamite back at the people, causing us harm. Now, there was this history. There was a history of even imported radical traditions coming from Europe and elsewhere from immigrants. And often we think about American exceptionalism, but what Marx and Engels thought about American exceptionalism is that it only lasts so far as the cheap land was lasting. And over time, the American experience would actually catch up to the experience of workers in Europe and these other capitalist countries in which the working class was increasingly deprived of land and resources and didn't have the safety valve of kind of going west. At the same time, you know, we were a country marked by the history of racism and these kind of divisions that impeded solidarity at times. But there were these real histories of multiracial radical organizing. The fight for the 8-hour day came from the United States. There was a huge syndicalist wing, so anarchist wing of the labor movement that came organically from the working class movement. There were little other socialist parties, like the Socialist Labor Party, that played a very important like theoretical influence on these debates happening in Europe and elsewhere. So there was this history. I think we were defeated. We weren't wrong, but we were defeated. We were crushed by state violence. The noble opposition of the Socialist Party to World War One, in part, provided an excuse for a tremendous Red Scare and the violence against us. Whereas other parties were more tightly disciplined and connected and united ideologically and otherwise, which enabled them to survive years underground in the U.S., we crumbled under the face of this repression. Through different factors, we were divided between a communist and a socialist movement. The working class anarchism kind of faded by the late 20s. We grapple with the fact we didn't have an independent workers' party. In these other countries, it was just taken for granted that you have a majority class, and the class doesn't consist of people who are all the same, but they do broadly have the same interests. And therefore, once you win political democracy, or through winning political democracy, you form a party that represents the interests of this vast majority. In the U.S., we had white male suffrage pretty early on. By the time that a workers' movement is really arising through the labor movement, many workers are already beholden to one of the two major parties. These parties constructed really ridiculously oppressive ballot laws and other things to make it very hard for a competitor to emerge. Through all these factors, we ended up having a working class movement that didn't have a party of its own, that I kind of had to creep in and out of these broader tent parties like the Democratic Party that were always really hostile to the most radical democratic expressions of working class political activity. And yeah, we've just been living in the history of, I think, some of it was circumstance, but some of it was just contingent defeats. But the defeats weren't just isolated events, they were cumulative. So every defeat made it harder for us to build something else. And this is where we are today, which is a weak and divided left. But one thing we should keep in mind is that the left, socialists in particular, have played an important role at the forefront of almost every single struggle for democracy and against forms of oppression and exploitation in the U.S. From the first left, I guess you could say, was the abolitionist movement, the role of the left there, to the struggle for the 8-hour day, to the struggle for suffrage and voting rights for women, to the struggle for unionization in the 30s, to, I think, our most profound victory, and the one the left played the biggest role in, which was the civil rights movement. We are living in a country that is grossly unequal and oppressive, but it's not the worst of all possible worlds, in part because of the struggles and sacrifices of the generations that came before us. So there is a left. It has existed. It's done some good things. It just hasn't maybe reached the heights that it has in other countries.
Well, in thinking about that history, that the conundrum of why there has not been a working class party in the U.S. and why social democracy, therefore, didn't take hold, or weren't the movements there to try and force social democracy to happen. Obviously, we're talking about a country that is, while one might want to avoid American exceptionalism, there is one aspect of the United States which is exceptional in that it has been at the center, fundamentally, of managing international capitalism. So it has played a different role than, say, a Sweden. Do you think that has relevance in terms of thinking about the fate of the left in the U.S. and the appeal for people in the working class to turn toward more radical possibilities?
No, actually, I don't think so. And that, obviously, I don't deny that the U.S. is at the heart of an imperial project that has different wings. So one of them is the direct military conquest at times, but often coups and trade embargoes and manipulations of the political process in other countries in order to be the referees of global capitalism. And that's undoubtedly true. But I reject the idea that there's the fruits from exploitation that are actually benefiting American workers. So to some extent, are people ideologically indoctrinated in the project? Or do they associate themselves with this national or imperial project? Maybe at times, but if you think about working class sentiments about wars, let's say, between now and the Vietnam War, for example, the most consistent opponents of the U.S. military adventures overseas has been the American working class. So obviously on the census, they don't like have you check a form that says proletarian, petty bourgeois, bourgeois. But we can use education attainment levels as a proxy for class. And in her book, Penny Lewis's book about hard hats and hawks and doves. It's a very good book. Penny Lewis, Vietnam War. You can look it up. She cites a lot of interesting polling data that says that from 1965 onward, the vast majority of working class people or people without a college diploma, which is high school education or below, were against the war, whereas educated professionals were for the war. In the case of people with graduate degrees, they're for the war until the very end. Among people with just college degrees, eventually they were in the middle. Then after the peace movement really exploded, they became more anti-war. So I think there is this real sentiment of saying, even if it's just an isolationist, not really the anti-imperialist one we would want, just like, that's none of my business, let's get out of there, why are they sending us to war, whatever else. And I don't think the U.S. Working class is actually benefiting from imperialism in the sense that Leninists thought they would have. So let's say in Lenin's theory or view of imperialism, you would consider foreign direct investment, or what we call foreign direct investment today, as a proxy for imperialism. And in that idea, the imperial country is investing in these other countries and then extracting kind of a rent or return on their investment. And to buy off their working class, they're giving a chunk of this extra surplus to working people. But in fact, just look at the last 30 years. Foreign direct investment is at new peaks, but real wages for working people in the U.S. are declining. So yeah, I don't think that we're benefiting, and that should actually, give us some sort of hope, because we're telling people you could in fact break this imperial system, you could in fact radically change the U.S. relationship to other states, and it won't lead to austerity or pain for working people. It'll just help both us here and people, our brothers and sisters abroad.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with Bhaskar Sankara about his book, The Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Era of Extreme Inequality. And that's published by Basic Books. Well, let's talk about, since it's basically unavoidable if one's talking about socialism, and obviously, particularly with a title like The Socialist Manifesto, one thinks of the history of the communist movement, and particularly about the experience of the Soviet Union. What is your take on that Soviet experience? So much of it was tragic and brutal. Is there something that you think can be salvaged from that past, and how do you think about it?
Well, I think the initial moments of the revolution can be salvaged. I mean, these were the most oppressed people in Europe. These are people who were suffering under the weight of feudalism, that were being sent to the front to fight in this brutal war, who just have dealt with all sorts of degradation, and they had in their mind they could organize together and create something different. And I think we need to reject the anti-communism that says that even thinking that you could transform the world is in itself a crime that will inevitably lead to all these things. Obviously, the revolution became isolated, and in these conditions of civil war, of famine, of just absolute disaster, they had to create a socialism that was less about emancipating working people and more about restoring production, restoring wealth. And this meant that a layer of bureaucrats, a layer of coordinators, were put in charge of directing these workplaces. They weren't exactly capitalists, but they were playing that kind of role. And it meant that dissent from Russia's very rich movement of democratic socialists, of anarchists, a whole host of left-wing parties had existed and survived, even under Tsarism, survived underground, were seen as threats and crushed. And anyone not supporting the goal of defending against the West by building socialism in one country, of pursuing these radical experiments, of very quickly building heavy industry and very quickly collectivizing farms and whatnot, was seen as ideologically suspect and summarily, imprisoned and oppressed and whatnot. So it very quickly went wrong. But I think we need to reject the idea that Lenin inevitably leads to Stalin. Because if we believe that, then it's very easy for our foes to say that, well, you know, Marx inevitably leads to Lenin, and, you know, by juxtaposition, Marx leads to Stalin. So we need to examine the history. We need to see what happens. We need to examine it in context. And we can't just from afar, I think, rely on the very easy moralistic, well, we're better people, we're Democrats, you know, and they weren't Democrats, and small d Democrats, of course. And actually just think about the context they were in and how our context differs. But beyond that, we need a commitment to a free civil society and to the support for opposing viewpoints. You can't have a dynamic political process. You can't have, even today, a dynamic left unless different parts of the left are able to convene together and talk with each other and have debates and disagreements, but figure out how to do it in a certain framework. In the same way, if you start to say only revolutionary thought is allowed, counter-revolutionary thought isn't allowed, then the line becomes blurred very quickly. And, you know, legitimate parts of working class political sentiments are snuffed out and attacked. And I think we need to have the confidence to say our ideas are right. Our ideas are in the interest of the vast majority. And we can make open democratic cases for our ideas. But it's worth saying that socialist, anarchists, social democrats, a whole host of the spectrum of the left had opposed Stalinism, not from the right, but from the left, for decades and decades and decades. Many of the movements that brought down state socialism, organized under labor and left-wing banners, there was always competing currents of thought, even within the Soviet Union, and that it wasn't this totalitarian thing that, you know, people couldn't resist or they're afraid to think or whatnot. Otherwise, it wouldn't have collapsed. I think that underestimates the capacity of people to fight against authoritarianism and fight against oppression and build a better future. And what people wanted when they rose up in the late 80s and early 90s, it wasn't civil war, it wasn't nationalism, it wasn't rule by a even more rapacious set of oligarchs that didn't even, you know, the Soviet Union, you could say, was run by a set of state bureaucrats and a set of, I guess, state oligarchs, but at least they drew some of their legitimacy off providing a basic social safety net for people. So clearly what's happened in Russia has been a disaster. And I think we need to say that it's not either or. We don't either have to end up in this kind of, you know, really brutal form of capitalism or go back to some sort of stifling state socialism. There was plenty of other alternatives that could have been pursued.
Well, and in that spirit, in your book, The Socialist Manifesto, you look at a number of different models in this broad socialist tradition beyond the Soviet Union, and you also turn your focus to the Scandinavian social democracies. Now, actually, the Scandinavian social democracies may not be the way we think of them when we think of that experience, but tell us about how those came to pass and what you draw from that experience.
So I've been on the left for a very long time. I'm 29 now, but I think I first became a self-described socialist when I was 13 or 14. I joined the organized socialist movement and, you know, joined Democratic Socialists of America when I was 17. So for not just the majority of my adult life, but kind of the majority of my life. And throughout many of those years, it's not that I didn't like the Nordic countries. I just assumed, you know, this has nothing really to do with the radical tradition. This is just, you know, a good form of state-managed capitalism as opposed to bad forms of capitalism or worse forms of capitalism. But through writing this book and through thinking about these issues for the last couple of years, I saw that, well, in fact, these Nordic countries were incredibly violent and unequal countries, and social democracy managed to increase the power of working people, democratize these countries. It managed to decommodify, so by decommodify, I mean taking out of the market huge spheres of society. So whereas before you had to struggle to survive, just like we do in the U.S., in those countries, housing and childcare and healthcare became guaranteed as social rights. But more importantly, these things were won through class organization and through class struggle. And ultimately, it wasn't that the welfare state bought off workers and caused them to say, all right, we're happy with what we have, or we're getting all these things from capitalism. You know, we support capitalism. In fact, it radicalized them. So in the 40s and 50s, you have this massive expansion in the Swedish welfare state. So workers are getting more comfortable. They're getting wealthier than ever. But by 1967, 1968, workers are actually going on strike, not just for bread and butter issues, but they're going on strike for industrial democracy. They're questioning the right of managers to manage. They're pushing their collective bargaining agreements into these kind of non-economic spheres. Eventually, from the 1970s, there's even proposals to form a wage earner fund, which would have slowly bought up the shares in Swedish companies and given them, you know, control to these collective funds run by the workers. Ultimately, what these left-wing currents within social democracy were trying to do was resolve the dilemma of social democracy giving more and more power, more and more rights to workers, but at the same time leaving the levers of control in the hands of private capitalists. So, at some point these capitalists could say the class compromise, the bargain that was working for us in the 40s and 50s is no longer working for us. And guess what? We could just stop investing in the economy. We could flee to another country. We could point to all these wage demands you're making and say you're cutting into our profits. We could say that, you know, international competition is intensifying, which it was, or the OPEC crisis of the 1970s. They had all these credible reasons to say we're just not going to invest until you dial back your demands. So either we accept that capitalist blackmail and we accept the fact that we're never going to live in a true democracy, or we say we're going to find a way to take that power away from capital by taking their ability to withhold investment away from them. And that means socializing their power through selective nationalizations, through creating these forms of collective ownership from workers, through supporting cooperatives, a whole host of ways we could do it. So what I ended up seeing was that the road to socialism and the road to social democracy and the road to reforms weren't different ones. It was just that, you know, the Swedish workers' movement stopped 75% of the way and were rolled back to, you know, 50%. You know, but they still have more than what we have. But I stopped seeing it as being counterposed, and I rejected this old idea that social democracy, the welfare state, buys off workers. In fact, I think it's close to the opposite. It radicalizes people. It causes them to expect more. You know, if you're in a condition where there's 10%, 20% unemployment in your area, you're going to be a lot less likely, all things being equal, to go on strike than if you're in a place with virtual full employment. You know, these kind of things are common sense, but it hasn't always been explained that way in our left or social democracy, socialist currents.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Bhaskar Sankara. He is the publisher of Jacobin, as well as Catalyst and now Tribune in the UK. And he is the author of The Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Era of Extreme Inequality. That's published by Basic Books, and you can find a link to it on againstthegrain.org. His other books include The ABCs of Socialism. So you've been tracing some of the history of the socialist movement. You talked about the Soviet Union. You talked about the Scandinavian model and the flaws of both. In a sense, they're a stand-in for also two different kind of models. One is a state-planned economy in the Soviet case and more of a market socialism in the Scandinavian countries. Since this isn't just an exercise in exploring the past, but exploring the past to think about the present and what kind of vision the left could put forward for socialism today, where do you fall on those, or is there another way?
Yeah, so I actually try to open the book with making a case for socialism and what a feasible socialism could look like, rather than just, you know, making a case against capitalism, because I think a lot of these books that say they're about socialism are, in fact, just, you know, about explaining why capitalism is bad. And I think we need to go a little bit deeper and further than that. Now, I think we should start with what's our moral starting point. We think that exploitation is bad and should be mitigated and abolished. We think that the fact that some people own production and are bosses that lord over other people is a form of exploitation, and then we should get rid of that relationship. We're against oppression. We want to limit hierarchy as much as possible. So this is a starting point for socialists. Then we need to say, all right, well, we need whatever society can best embody those values to the extent possible. Now, that's going to be a combination in my mind of planning and markets. We have to think about what is it in market society today that we object to. And to me, the thing that we object to is market dependence. The fact that somebody has to work for a private capitalist in order to survive, and they have no alternative to this system, and the penalties for not playing ball is going to be poverty and destitution. Now, if you have even a social democracy, or a very robust social democracy, beyond what they have in Sweden, you could get rid of this form of market dependence by guaranteeing the basics of life, at least, as social rights. Now, the commanding heights, as they used to say in the old language of the left, of the economy, things like natural monopolies, things like health insurance, things like our telecommunications industry, all these things I think should be run by a democratic, accountable state, but it should be run by the state. But in the sphere for consumer goods, if you no longer have this brutal form of market dependence and you no longer have private bosses because you've turned these firms into worker-controlled enterprises, then to me, these firms competing against each other, so there's mechanisms for setting prices, there's mechanisms for weeding out inefficient firms, firms that could then, maybe restart in some different form. This isn't creating exploitation. This isn't creating oppression. This isn't at odds with the value of a society. So I guess I do believe that in this sphere for consumer societies, worker-controlled firms could be competing in a regulated market. In fact, I think there are calculation and incentive problems that we haven't yet overcome to a fully planned economy. Perhaps in the future, with changes in technology or whatnot, we'll be able to at least overcome the calculation problems. Perhaps in a future with enough abundance, we already have lots of abundance, but even more abundance in the world, we would be able to overcome incentive issues. But that's kind of my model, a mix of planned and market, but not the kind of markets we have under capitalism.
You mentioned that so much of the literature that frames itself as radical doesn't put forward a positive vision. It's obviously very easy to criticize capitalism. It's much harder to propose something to replace it. And that is a sentiment that I think one could say is widely shared on the left. People can come together with a big no. It's much harder to propose a vision for change. And it reinforces a situation in which we have been told there's no alternative to the capitalism that we have. This dimension of the left having very little to present as an alternative seems, at least from my standpoint, to be adding to that dynamic. Do you think that such a vision needs to be articulated in a way that is complex or just in really broad terms? Like, do you think there are people standing on the sidelines saying, I jump into the socialist fray, but, they haven't figured out these calculation problems? Or do you think it's something broader?
Well, I think our mass appeals have to be for these day-to-day reforms, for things like Medicare for All, for a jobs guarantee, for universal child care, for rent controls, and ultimately also for social housing. Things where we could win people on now, we explain, and it's tangible or whatnot. I think the dynamics of this will be such that it'll open up these deeper questions down the road. But I think for people within the socialist movement who want to not just fight for these reforms, but also wants to lay out this roadmap, having a horizon of what a good society should be like, about how it could work, having these thought experiments is extremely useful. In Marx's day, he used to criticize writing recipes for the cookshops of the future. The logic was twofold. Now, one was the fact that the existing socialist movement were largely these utopian movements that were created often by kind of like wealthy, like philanthropists who wanted to create their ideal society through like blue pointing exactly like what the society would look like. It would be like you would drop out and join this ideal society and become a model for the rest of society. So they were obviously rejecting that. But they're also rejecting the inherent authoritarianism and the idea of saying, we small group of isolated intellectuals who are already socialists have this vision that one day a working class movement should just put into practice. So I think we have to keep in mind that any of these provisioning or thinking should be like, well, very provisional. And we should think about the way in which people in their own situations, their own context will remake them and things like that. But right now, the barriers aren't just political barriers. People think there's technological barriers or technical barriers to change, and we need to break through that and tell them, well, in fact, there's a different way. In fact, if you see a lot of homelessness and there's vacant luxury housing, but there's also, you know, not enough housing stock, well, we could build more homes and we could convert these luxury housing into, you know, safe, livable, you know, accommodations for people. You know, breaking the logic of false scarcity that I think is inherent in a lot of capitalism, where, you know, when I was a child, that's what I thought should be done. You know, you see a homeless person, why don't they have a house? And that logic is so natural to us as human beings. But over time, it becomes kind of eaten at us and say, oh, everything's so complex, we can't handle this, and so on and so on. So I think people really want to hear it. They want to believe that there's a different world. And we have to both convince them that we can organize to get there, but also convince them that it's feasible and it's possible.
Okay, so how do we get from here to there? What are the ingredients that you think are necessary? You mentioned three in the past: mass parties, an activist base, and a mobilized working class. Why have these three components mattered?
Well, I think, first of all, the reason why socialists often talk about workers isn't because they're oppressed and weak. It's actually quite the opposite. They're the people with leverage because they're positioned in the economy in such a way that if they go on strike and threaten to withhold their labor power, capitalists no longer make profits, and you could actually create a lot of concessions. You could make demands. 2,000 well-organized people in the right node of society, and you see this a lot with the longshore workers around here, at least you used to, can fight back and can, in fact, disrupt society for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. So that strategic position is why we talk about the working class. Now, there needs to be a layer of activists organically coming from this class that are a little bit ahead of others and seeing some of this class dynamics and seeing that, in fact, there's political solutions to their problems. And these people aren't meant to just take the stolen wisdom and you know, kind of from above and pose it onto people. But they're meant to create the infrastructures of dissent that make it more rational for people to fight back. Right now, workers don't fight back often in the United States, not because they're dumb, but because they're smart. They know that collective action is risky, and it's often safer to just, let's say your hours get cut back by a third of your job, but you're in a community where there's not many jobs. It's often better just to keep your head down, to maybe ask friends and family for help, or maybe to pick up a shift like driving an Uber or Lyft on the side. You know, this is people's response, and it's actually probably more rational for a working class person than joining DSA or trying to figure out how to go on strike. But what socialists can do is actually help support the institutions that make it a viable option to fight back. So, I live now in New York City. The Jackman office is in Brooklyn. There's a DSA group in Brooklyn that is disproportionately white, disproportionately middle class. Now, they could either sit around the thousand of them and say, oh, we're too white, we're too middle class, and it's kind of some struggle sessions, or they can support the Crown Heights Tenants Union, which a lot of them are doing, and all these other institutions that actually give the disproportionately black and brown working class people in these, you know, communities the ability to fight back against their landlords. And that's, by the way, what they would want them to do. Yeah. And I think that's the key. We take our small base where we take our militant minorities, like with the teachers, you know, strike, these layers of times just dozens of people that are formulating ideas and communicating with each other, and they figure out how to reach their colleagues, and then a national context changes, and now there's a strike. So we need both the work of small groups of people, but it has to be connected to kind of a wider, broader base. But we start now with what's popular and where people are at. We can't be too far ahead of them. And right now, the Bernie Sanders campaign, I think, is an exciting space for socialists to be engaging with. I think this wave of activism going on, not just within the teachers unions, nurses unions, but even new resurgent efforts to democratize existing unions like Teamsters for a Democratic Union and these other efforts are important places for socialists to fight, especially on the West Coast. Housing is a very important issue. I mean, the housing crisis is obviously big in New York, but, you know, just seeing in the Bay Area, I was just in Seattle before then, the amount of the combination of both massive construction but also homelessness, right? And obviously that luxury construction is not going to trickle down, at least in the next 100 years. You know, it's not going to be of help for the people suffering right now. So there's a lot of things you could get engaged with. But our idea has to be we're going to create the infrastructure that will allow people to fight back and emancipate themselves. Our idea can't be we're going to lay out a master plan or a 10-point program and the masses are going to rally to us kind of naturally. It has to be a dynamic process. So I think often the criticism that Jackman gets and sometimes I get is, okay, when you talk about socialist theory, when you talk about what the left should be doing or a vision of an anti-capitalist society, that sounds good, but why do you also, you know, do campaign videos for Bernie Sanders and why do you also do this? I think it's an important part of the bridge. You know, it's if you can't put Medicare for all on the table, like I said, you know, you're not going to be able to put worker ownership, the means of production, on the table.
Well, let's talk about that and political parties in that, because that's part of the ingredients that you flagged. Political parties have, in different parts of the spectrum, been tainted on the left. On the one hand, you have the sects, these tiny groups, which have framed themselves as being in the vanguard and often been quite authoritarian and often pretty much irrelevant. On the other hand, there are the political parties of more mainstream politics, and we can obviously think about the Democratic Party and all the institutional weight that has it pulled toward neoliberalism and structured toward it, in fact. When you say political parties, what are you thinking of here?
So I believe that there needs to be some sort of way for people to both participate in electoral politics, but also just get involved in their community, get involved in their unions, and can unite around some sort of pro-working class program of democracy, of redistribution and whatnot. And in a lot of countries, you could do that through a political party. So right now on the U.S. left, we often talk about ideological socialists, let's say. We talk about people doing trade union work, and we talk about electoral politics, and we talk about social movements. Like, they're four separate things. If we really had a party to coordinate our activities, a democratic party from below, a mass party, then we could talk about them as one and the same. They would just be different expressions of working class activity, and they'd be coordinated and enhanced by a party, not directed from above, but enhanced. In the U.S., we never even have had a bad workers' party, like a reformist one, to betray us. We never even got that opportunity. We were never able to construct one. So today, I think as an intermediary thing, you can imagine the future, socialists continuing to run, sometimes as independents, sometimes within the Democratic Party, sometimes within parties like the Green Party, and running not as Democrats or not as Republicans or Greens or whatever, but running as socialists and agreeing to a common, like, you know, set of programmatic ideas and getting their funding from certain sources like progressive unions and a socialist group, for example, only, and kind of creating a shell of a party without necessarily fighting right away for ballot line access, because that's the most difficult thing in the U.S. We have such authoritarian ballot line laws, it's almost impossible to maintain them without spending just all of your energy and resources just on this one thing. But in the long run, I still think this is an important thing we need to do. I'm not sure, or I don't believe, that we could transform the Democratic Party into this kind of left organization, this left party. I think there's a lot of people who have good intentions who are trying to do that right now. And my stance is generally to express the view that I don't think this is going to work, but we don't really have our own model. We can't tell people who are, let's say, active injustice Democrats or someone like AOC, we can't say, you really should be in an independent workers' party, because our strategy hasn't worked either. So I guess that's what's something we've been trying to do in Jacobin, is trying to bridge the two different strategies and figure out if there's another route. And Seth Ackerman actually wrote this piece, which is widely circulated in DS headquarters, at least, called Blueprint for a New Party in late 2016 that made some of these arguments.
Bhaskar Sankara is my guest. He is the author of The Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Era of Extreme Inequality. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So in terms of how this would get us to the kind of vision that you mentioned earlier, the vision of a society where exploitation would not take place, obviously that seems a long way off, but you make an argument for social democracy and then moving from social democracy to democratic socialism. It's a big question, but how do you see that arc?
Well, yeah, I think that social democracy is us getting pretty far along the path of taming and controlling the power of capital. Socialism would be finally taking the next step and overcoming the tyranny of capital. So I see it as on the same road. And I look at the example of Sweden, these other countries, I figure we need to find a way to either all at once through expropriation when we have a democratic mandate, or through some sort of gradual program of taking away the power of capital. But ideally, social democracy should be preventing capital's ability as it progresses from exerting its control. If we leave them with too much power, then they'll be able to just upend the system, because fundamentally, we are dependent on our bosses and they're dependent on us, but it's an asymmetrical dependency. We need our bosses and we need our jobs as individual workers much more than they need our services as an individual worker. That's why we need to band together collectively. But banding together collectively is difficult. It comes in with all sorts of other roadblocks. There's all sorts of divisions among each other. There's all sorts of reasons why, you know, take the Lyft and Uber attempted strike a few days ago. Now, can you imagine struggling to make ends meet? You're taking home 25, 26 grand a year driving for Uber, and some of your colleagues, I guess, are on strike. Not that you actually know them, because they're kind of independently working, and you're seeing this incentive to go out there and drive, and maybe you could earn double the fare because people aren't on the road. Can we really blame someone? Will we denounce them as a scab, especially since they don't have a union, they don't have access to a strike fund, for going out there and driving? So overcoming these dilemmas of collective action is the most difficult part. But what social democracy and a movement, at least growing a movement over time, should do is make it easier to overcome these dilemmas. But the question isn't just what kind of reforms you're fighting for. The question is how you're fighting for them. So there's a big difference to me between getting Medicare for all by saying we're going to sit down at the table with business and we're going to convince GM that, in fact, if they didn't have to pay for their employer-sponsored health insurance policy, they would save money, and the inefficiency in America's healthcare is a drain on its economy and whatever else. This kind of corporatist vision of change is very different than saying, you know what, the healthcare CEOs, the executives, these big business leaders don't want you to have nice things. We're going to fight them, and we're gonna actually win something. There's a huge difference between those two. So it's not just whether you're fighting reforms or not. It's how you're fighting for reforms.
A lot of people would immediately wonder if there was the kind of mass organization that was necessary to get a social democratic state in the United States, that one would be organizing and pushing things to that extent, that if things were at that level, that by entering into the state in various capacities, wouldn't that defang those radical movements that allowed all of this to happen? And I just, because I'm afraid we're almost out of time, append another thing, which is that as climate change, as the effects of climate change are getting worse and worse, the left is also in a funny position in that it's being pushed in some ways ever more into the arms of the liberal state, because we just want someone in mm-hmm. charge to stop, right? To stop the warming, to regulate. And so isn't there the danger here that if there are the capacities, the radical capacities to really, on the kind of scale that would be necessary to achieve even sort of modest social democratic goals in the United States, given the history that would be pushing back and all the forces that would be pushing back massively against that. Isn't there the danger that things would stop at that point and the movements that propelled it would be defanged?
Well, it's a really tricky dilemma, let's say, when it comes to climate change, in part because it's almost like the struggle against fascism, right? Like, we know that Churchill's an imperialist. We know that Roosevelt is an arch capitalist. But when the alternative is Hitler, then, you know, it was very, you know, there's kind of some sense in the communist appeal to just rally behind the lesser evils and defeat this imminent threat to civilization. Now, I think our stance has to be, we're going to demand a radical working class program to fight for a Green New Deal and things like that. Incidentally, because these reforms are within the system, some green capitalists are going to benefit, maybe, incidentally. But we're not going to, from the beginning, say we're making an alliance with the good people and, you know, we're going to make Coca-Cola shift their recyclable bottles and, you know, whatever else. So we make it a jobs-focused, wage-focused, pro-working class environmentalism. And and this is one thing that, for all its flaws, AOC's Green New Deal has really taken environmentalism from the hands of the Sierra Club and brought it to a place where hopefully in the future you could see unions even jumping on board with it. Now, with the state, I think, one, the history is that even these trade union confederations, even these parties, the rank and file of these parties that had state power, are still radicalized over time. It's true, though, that there are certain other pressures, bureaucratic and other pressures that arise if you're trying to create the social democratic road to socialism. And we need to figure out a way to fight against that. I think it's by making sure that our leaderships, both in parties and unions, are democratically accountable, by fostering rank and file power, by even doing things like having term limits and rotating office and all these other things that seem like they're little technocratic fixes, in fact, are often really healthy for the dynamics of groups and organizations. Making sure, for example, that our steering committees of our organizations are diverse and have women in leadership positions and whatnot. When neoliberals use it to just say this is the only thing we need in society, then that's a silly thing. But when, you know, we use it to make our movements more inclusive and more representative of the working class as a whole, that's a good thing. So I think there's a political battle to face, but it's not inevitable that this would happen. But the way the capture really happens isn't because our bureaucrats are directly bought off by capitalists or whatever else. The way this happens is simply, if you're running a state, you're dependent on private profits. So you do, let's say, half of a cycle. If you can imagine, half of a cycle is that you start off with your program, you try to institute your program, then you get some sort of feedback from business. Then there's the business environment worsens, there's pressure against you, they're withholding investment, companies are keeping their money in savings instead of productively investing it. Then your next round of legislation is going to be more moderate. Then eventually you're going to be rewarded. Then you're going to see, we're not doing what we want to do, but growth is up 4%. We could distribute some of that, maybe support our National Health Service or whatever else. We need to break this cycle by taking power away from capital, by taking this power to withhold investment. And I think the way we construct movements to keep this in mind is, my vision, unfortunately, is very, what the old left would say, voluntaristic. It's very much dependent on having an ideological core of people, by having a mobilized rank and file, by doing political education, by explaining the dynamics at play, and telling people that if you want to preserve even this expansive welfare state, you need to know that big business is the enemy, even if they're pretending not to be right now. In the same way, if we want to preserve the environment, you know, the sons and daughters of big CEOs are going to be living on the same planet as us, but they have different interests. It's not a shared struggle of us as human beings. It's still a class struggle. So I think this is the reason why, you know, we need socialists. We need organizations like DSA. We need things like Jacobin. We need politicians like Socialist Alternative Sama Sawant. We need all these ideological groups, even if the base level of society shifts to the left and there's more mainstream class struggle in society.
Bhaskar Sankara, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
I've been speaking with the author of The Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Era of Extreme Inequality. That's published by Basic Books. And his other books include The ABCs of Socialism. He's the publisher of Jacobin, as well as Catalyst and Tribune. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time.